This is Harry Dilworth, and the time is late January 1985. I have decided to record on a series of tapes. The story, if you want to call it that, of my years in the Army Air Corps during World War II. I don't do this under the illusion that anybody in particular will be interested in hearing this stuff. I'm doing it entirely for my own satisfaction. I suppose it's possible that 50 or 100 years from now, some unsuspecting nephew might find this interesting. Who knows? Anyway, I intend to do it. Obviously, that was a long time ago, and I have to rely mostly on my memory, which is sometimes lacking and sometimes faulty, no doubt. Nothing I can do about that. On the other hand, I do have at my disposal a diary which covers most, but not all, of the year and a half in New Guinea. And I also have the benefit of a very large number of letters which I wrote home from flying school and from overseas, which my mother saved, and which a year or so ago I transcribed into typescript, and I'll try to use both of those to refresh my memory. But most of it's going to be done just out of my head. I'd like to begin by saying that when I joined the Army Air Corps on November the 7th, 1941, exactly 1 month prior to Pearl Harbor, I think no one, or most people, I should say, most people never thought I would make it through flying school. They were not being unkind, but the fact was that I was not your standard macho guy, never had been. I had never flown in an airplane in my life. I had no special mechanical aptitude. And in those days, the U.S. Army Air Corps was generally considered to be the elite flying group in this country, and people of some stature, I suppose. Well, circumstances changed all that. How did I happen to get into this in the first place? Well, it was pretty much like this. I graduated from William and Mary in June 1941, and it had been my intention always to go on somehow to graduate school and end up teaching English at some college or other. But as the year 1941 progressed, it became more and more obvious to more and more people that the United States was eventually going to join the English in World War II, and that people were going to be drafted, and that any thought of being able to survive through graduate school without being put into the armed forces any such thought was not realistic. So by the time I got out of William and Mary, I pretty well made up my mind that I would go into the Army or the Navy and get that done with, and afterwards return to graduate school. At that time, I had been very caught up in the Icelandic sagas, and I had got it into my head that the thing to do would be to try to get into the Navy and try to get assigned to Iceland so that I could learn to speak Icelandic and read the sagas in their original. This was not too realistic, but I didn't know that, and that's more or less the way I proceeded. Well, that summer, the summer of 41, I spent largely in Vermont with Aunt Toby. And she was fully in favor of my going into the military. And she knew, or some friend of hers knew, a Navy captain stationed in Boston. And the thought was that perhaps this gentleman could help me get what I wanted. So sometime, probably in July, she lent me her car and had me drive down to Boston by myself for a few days to see what was what. And I stayed in her apartment down there at the time. And I do remember going over someplace or other, probably the Boston Navy Yard, and having a conversation with this Navy captain, who was, as I remember, very kind. But I think that he saw from the beginning that, and probably told me so, that the Navy really wasn't doing anything much around Iceland, and that was not probably going to be anything that I could accomplish. So I left his office not feeling very much encouraged, but still determined to do something about getting into the Army or the Navy, and to do it then, or at least make preliminary arrangements. So I went one day into an Army recruiting office, and I talked to a sergeant there. And during the course of our conversation, he said to me, "Why don't you become an aviation cadet?" Well, I didn't even know what an aviation cadet was. But he explained to me that if you wanted to join the Army Air Corps and be a pilot, that you underwent some months of training as an aviation cadet. If you did not have a college education, you had to take a written examination in order to qualify for consideration. But since I already had a bachelor's degree from college, I didn't have to take any examination at all other than a physical one. Well, it sounded like a good enough idea to me, and so I agreed. So he set it up for me to go somewhere or other, and I don't remember where it was. I think probably it was I don't know, but it was a military installation of some sort in Boston. Hard to get to, as I remember. To go down there and have a thorough physical examination in order to be see if I qualified as an aviation cadet candidate. So I did that, and the examination was very thorough, as I remember it, and it took Well, certainly it took 2 days. Maybe three, but I know it took more than one. So I went down there every morning and spent much of the day there going through all these tests and so forth, sorts of things they gave you in those days. And the only thing I remember about that episode at all was the fact that one day when I was sitting around on a bench there, waiting further instructions at the examination center, a young man in his 20s, I suppose, who was a dentist and who had examined my teeth, came into the room and looked around and he said, "Is there someone in this room named Harry Dilworth?" And I said, "Yes, I was he." And he said, "I see that you come from Harrisonburg, Virginia." And I said, "I did." And he said, "Do you happen to know a man there by the name of Louis Claybrook?" Well, of course, I did know Louis Claybrook. Had known him for several years. And I don't remember at this time where this young dentist had known Louis. But he had, and he asked me to give Louis his greetings when I went back to Harrisonburg, and I said I would. Other than that, I don't remember any particular business about this exam thing, and when it was done with, they told me to simply go home, and I would eventually hear from them as to whether I had been accepted or not. But that it would take several months, so that I need not expect an answer anytime soon. So I went on back up to Vermont, and in the fall or whenever it was, back to Harrisonburg, and sat around waiting for word. At that time we were living at 291 Franklin Street, and everybody was home, a mother, father, Dick, Fred, and I guess. I don't remember what I did during that time, nothing much, but eventually one day I got a letter from the Army Air Corps saying you have been accepted as an aviation cadet in the class of 42F and will begin training on November the 7th in 1941, and you will be notified further when and where to report. That was about all, but that made it official. Now, I don't know, I don't remember now what my feelings were about all this, but I guess I figured that I might make it and I might not. And I certainly was aware that the training was likely to be rigorous and that there was likely to be a lot of hazing, which I didn't see myself as being well equipped to withstand. But I was game for trying it, and I was pleased about the prospect, and made up my mind. But if anyone were to ask me whether I thought I would get through flying school or not, now I don't know, but I'm sure it's much like battle, where people, nobody thinks he's going to be killed. He thinks other people will, but he won't. And I probably thought, well, some people will get washed out, as they called it, but I'll probably make it. I don't remember worrying about it, especially one way or the other. I doubt if I did. I was 21 years old and felt pretty good about things. And anyway, eventually, I had gotten other word, I suppose, from the Air Corps. Anyway, I was told to report at the Army Recruiting Center at the post office building in Richmond, on November 7th at some hour in the morning. And I remember that mother and father drove me down there. I think they were had lots of misgivings and probably forebodings for all I know. And I'm sure they were a good deal more disturbed about my prospects than I was. Just as well, anyway. Meaning that good thing I wasn't any more disturbed than I was. So I bade them farewell in front of the post office in Richmond and went indoors with a suitcase and went upstairs, as I remember, to a large room which was, as I remember it, practically filled with people like myself. Probably weren't that many, but seemed like it. Anyway, we hung around for a while and were eventually sworn in or something. Well, not or something. We were sworn in. And the Air Corps had apparently cooked up some arrangement with the press so that some fuss would be made over this thing. And they took us then in a bus down to the Richmond Airport. And I remember they had down there what I believe now was an old B-18 bomber and an AT-6 advanced trainer, which they let us climb around on, and they pressed, took lots of pictures and so on and so forth. I don't remember anything about the B-18 bomber. But I do remember climbing up on the wing of the AT-6 and looking into the cockpit and being quite impressed, if not intimidated, by the array of instruments and levers and gadgets there. I didn't know a thing in the world about airplanes. And anyway, it seems to me that after that we were taken somewhere and had a rather miserable supper, and were put on a train in Richmond, headed for Montgomery, Alabama, where Maxwell Field, the pre-flight training school, was located. At that time, there were three separate training areas for the Army Air Corps in the United States. There was the Southeast, I think, training center where Maxwell Field, people began at Maxwell Field. There was the Gulf Coast training area, and I think that Randolph Field was probably the place, the initial training place for that area. And then there was another one which encompassed everything else, meaning principally the West Coast. Okay, we got on this train and rode all night. We had bunks, berths, and got up in the morning and shaved and dressed and all that stuff and got into Montgomery. I don't know when. It seems to me probably early afternoon. Well, about that time, the unfun started. There were a bunch of big Army trucks lined up there, and a lot of, I suppose, enlisted men. I don't remember who they were, but Army people who were there to meet us, and they shouted and hollered at us, and, "Go here, go there, get going, mister, do this, do that." It was all rather a shock to me, and it was certainly disagreeable. Anyway, eventually we piled into all these trucks and got driven out to the field, and it took me many years ever to forget the sound that truck made as it went along and the forebodings that I had inside me at all this goings on and the what seemed to me the horrible prospects ahead. Well, we got out to the field and we're all dumped out and lined up, and they had some senior cadets there who were supposed to read us the riot act or something, I don't know. Anyway, they did holler around, and remember one of them said, "You come up here, you," to me. "Your coat button is unbuttoned. Is that the way you go around? Your coat unbuttoned. Well, you're not doing that here. You button that coat. Do you hear me, mister? Do you hear me?" And all. Well, there was a lot of that, and it went on and on while they hustled us about getting, I don't know what we were doing. Signing papers, probably. Mostly just standing in the cold. It was quite cold. I don't care if it was Alabama in November, but it was cold. And we were tired and hungry. We hadn't had anything to eat, as I remember. And anyway, we were hustled about from this place to that place, and it finally got dark, and we were still being hustled about and given haircuts, too. I remember that. The only funny thing that happened, though I don't know that I regarded it as so funny at the time, except that probably did derive some solace from it. But I remember we were standing around in the dark waiting, and there was this senior cadet who was in charge of us. And at one point, while we were just standing there, he came up close to us and looked around at everybody and said in a low voice, "If you guys think I'm enjoying this, you're crazy as hell." And then he stepped back into his place. Well, we got assigned to some barracks. Now, the barracks were permanent buildings, and they were very nice and well built and nice looking and comfortable. But they put us, six of us, in a room intended for who knows, three maybe, or even two. And the way they did this, they had the bunks, three bunks spaced evenly along the floor. And then they had three more bunks turned upside down and bolted to the bottom one so that they were double-deckers. And all the rooms, as well as I can remember, were done in this fashion. There were two desks at least, nice desks, and there was a wash basin in the room. And the room had a door opening into a bathroom, which was a bathroom and a shower room, and another door on the other side of the bathroom, which led into the next room. In other words, every two rooms shared a bath between them, but we didn't have to go outdoors or anything to get there. Now, you know, I don't remember all the people who were in that, the five other people who were in that room with me, but I remember some of them because I was destined to be with at least three of them for close to a year, I suppose, maybe more. Anyway, first I remember there was Charlie Smith. Charlie Smith looked like a brigand. He was a tall, skinny guy from Southwest Virginia. And He looked like a brigand. I wouldn't wanted to meet him in a dark street night. He had been in the army previously, and that was a blessing because he knew a lot about what was what. And when he wanted to argue with you over something or dispute us something, he would always say, "Now will you just let me quote with you? Let me quote with you a minute." And I always remember that. He was a very nice fellow, very even-tempered, and not objectionable in any way that I remember. There was a soft-spoken, almost mousy young man about my age named Smith. I'm trying to think of his first name. which I can't at the moment, but we always called him Snuffy. I don't know why, but we did. He was always known as Snuffy. And he was from Virginia also, up near Manassas, someplace up in there. Very, very nice guy. Didn't talk much, and as I said, when he did, he was quite soft-spoken. And maybe I'll interject at this point. In the years ahead, he married an Australian girl, and sometime after the war was over, and I was back in Harrisonburg on Franklin Street, Snuffy Smith and his wife came to visit. And Father was there, and Mother, and Dick, and Fred, and some of us, Father and Dick and I, no doubt, and I don't know who else, were playing cards out on the front porch. And Snuffy sort of looked over people's shoulders and watched what was going on. And I remember on several occasions he astonished me, and Dick and Fred too, I'm sure, by slapping Father soundly on the back and saying, "That's it, old man! That's it, old man! Get him, old man! That's it, old man!" And Mother, of course, found this hilarious, but the funny part was Father did too. And he used to ask me in the years after that, "Where's your friend Snuffy?" or whatever his name is. And this apparently pleased Snuffy. But Dick and Fred and I never dreamed of slapping Father on the back, let alone calling him old man. Well, that was Snuffy Smith. There was another boy in the room from New Jersey, and his name was Joe Hensler. H-E-N-S-L-E-R, and I always thought, still do, I suppose, that Joe was extremely good-looking. Well, he was, I think. Probably not as good-looking as I thought he was, but he was very good-looking. And, again, rather soft-spoken, and he had a nice laugh. Matter of fact, I think I could easily say that I thought Joe Hensler had the nicest speaking voice of anybody I have ever known in my life that I can remember. It was an extremely pleasant voice. He was a nice guy. Then there was another tall, gangly mountaineer from Virginia, and I swear to goodness, I can't remember his name at all, not even his first name. He was ugly, too. But he had a Lincoln Zephyr. I remember being very impressed by that. That's four boys. The fifth one, I hardly remember at all. But he was—he had been a rat in a former life, and he still looked somewhat like a rat. He was small and skinny and had a rat face and rat eyes. And his father was a master sergeant in the army. I don't remember his name at all. He never bothered anybody much, so I don't even remember his first name. But those were the six of us in that room. And somewhere along the line here, we got fed supper, and we went to bed. I don't think anybody slept very well. I'm sure I didn't, though I don't have any recollections about it one way or the other. I just remember being utterly terrified of the whole bit and thinking it was a nightmare. And early the next morning, we were rudely awakened in some fashion or other, probably somebody banging on the door, and hustled out. We were still in civilian clothes. And we were taken around, marched here and marched there and the other place, and we were given some drill on how to march, I think, here and there and the other place, and getting clothes. And they gave us all our clothes, and a huge amount of clothes they were. Everything, underwear, shirts, socks, pants, overcoat, whole bunch of stuff. Dress uniforms, caps, you name it, handkerchiefs. Somewhere we got this, and we were instructed to put them on, and I remember after that, that there was some way of determining first thing in the morning what the uniform of the day was to be. In other words, what clothes were you going to put on that day? Because everybody had to wear the same thing, and there was some way of determining that. So in the morning when you get up, that was the first thing you had to find out, was what you're going to wear. And shoes, oh yeah, we got shoes too, of course. Raincoat, I don't know. I don't have a very clear recollection anymore about the mess hall, but it was a huge, enormous place, and we had to form up in formation outside the barracks before meals, and then we had a band march us down to the mess hall, which was about half a mile, I suppose, maybe less, I don't know. And in the mess hall, there was all kind of elaborate procedures. If you wanted, there was, for example, a pitcher of milk on the table, and if you wanted milk,